Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Ryan McCaffrey with IGN. We're here at the DICE Summit for 2019 in Las Vegas. We're up in a suite at the Aria Hotel, and I'm very pleased to be joined by the great Amy Hennig, longtime game designer, one of the best storytellers in our industry. Thank you so much
for sitting down
with me, Amy.
This is great. I apologize for my voice. This is DICE voice. I don't usually sound quite this... Much like a, you know, two-pack-a-day smoker.
It's Vegas. There's smoking indoors at the casinos and all kinds of stuff.
It's all bad.
Well, but what is, you know, this is an interesting, this is my first time at DICE. You've been to plenty of these. What's your favorite part about DICE?
I actually haven't been to many of these. I think until last year, I had only come for the awards. And that was fun.
Yeah.
But, like, it was kind of, you were in and out, and didn't have a lot of chance to really socialize that much. So what I like about it is the fact that it's kind of a more intimate event than some others, and that it's so easy just to run into people and have these impromptu conversations. You inevitably make all of these connections and walk away with, you know, a stack of business cards of people that, you know, you can follow up with. And it's just a great, I mean, I hate the word networking, it all seems so sort of mercenary, but it's a great place to actually connect and, like, have those kind of serendipitous conversations.
Right, that I suppose game developers don't traditionally get those opportunities because you're busy at your studio working on your thing, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's usually, I mean, look, I'm fortunate now to be kind of master of my own schedule and time and fate right now, but, like, yeah, usually we couldn't really take the time. That's why we would just fly in for the awards and then maybe stay over and then fly home.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I wanted to ask you about next is, you know, you were years at Crystal Dynamics, years at Naughty Dog, some time at EA, and now you've been on your own for the last year or two. So how has that change been in your life?
Look, I mean, I took, you know, the events with EA as a little bit of an opportunity to, like, maybe just step back and kind of just, like, take a breather and reassess and fill the tank, because I'd actually been kind of going and going for almost 30 years.
Wow.
And, like, this is, I mean, to take a year off like this, you know, and I mean, and look, I still haven't taken a year off. I'm you know, taking contracting gigs and consulting and then, you know, kind of out there hustling and taking meetings and stuff like that. But it's been good because I feel like my own little crossroads inflection point is the industries, you know. Not to be solipsistic about it, you know, but it's like I feel like my situation maybe and kind of trying to figure out what I want to do next is somewhat symptomatic of where this inflection point we're at with the industry. And so I thought, well, not only, I mean, thankfully, I sold some EA stock right at the peak, so that was awesome. And I had enough in the bank to just be able to go, okay, like, I don't have to work right now. I can just sort of, like, you know, take a break. And then I felt like for all the years of my career that I'd been taking things out of the inspiration tank and not filling it back up. And so having a year to just, you know, kind of just spend some time and, like, you know, look around at the world, read some books, you know, like, watch some movies, play some other games. It's like, it's been reinvigorating. And then it's fascinating because I'm unaffiliated, I can kind of talk to anybody in the industry.
Yeah.
So it's been great. It's kind of, I feel like a tourist. Like, I'm just kind of going around, taking little gigs that interest me, talking to people, and not even, like, trying to, like, hustle for work. Like, I'm not even, don't have the urgency of trying to pitch anyone. I just have the opportunity to just say, like, what do you think about where we're at with the industry? What do you think is next? And be able to connect some dots.
And that sounds like it's also part of refilling that tank.
It is, right?
Is talking to everybody.
Because you get inspired by other people, you know, and you start figuring out, you know, who are those people that, like, are really present and kind of spark your, you know, your passion and imagination, and, you know, try to connect with them. And you know, like I said, it's interesting because you get the chance to stand back and kind of see the whole matrix of the industry and how everything connects, and maybe in ways that, you know, even all the people I'm talking to don't quite have the benefit of, you know.
So you've been, you're telling me you've been toying around with VR, like specifically sort of zoning in on storytelling and can VR, or how can VR be a good opportunity for that? So kind of what have you found as you've just hooked all those systems up and started to toy around with them.
Yeah, look, I mean, this, as soon as I left EA, I spent a lot of time thinking, okay, well, look, fundamentally, I want to tell stories, right? I want to tell interactive stories. What are all the new ways of doing that? We have these new devices and, you know, new mediums, rather than just sort of turning the same old AAA crank again, which seems harder and harder to do. And so VR was a natural thing to explore, and because I feel like we still have yet to crack, you know, how we tell good stories in virtual reality. Problem is, I mean, it's still early days. It's, you know, the business model is unclear, but it's been fun. I mean, I got the Vive Pro, and I got, you know, the Oculus, and I got the PSVR, and, you know, got them all set up. I got sensors everywhere, and just sort of sampling things. And some stuff is, I mean, like some games like Lone Echo are amazing. It makes you start thinking about, like, different ways of, you know, kind of more viscerally affecting, you know, people through, you know, these mechanics.
Yeah.
But the storytelling part is really hard. And, like, I would love to crack the problem because it feels to me like VR is in the same place that, you know, film was at, you know, in the early days, where it's like, okay, well, can we move the camera? Can we do this? Like, how do we edit? What's the language of VR?
Right.
I'd love to be part of that. It's just a little bit hard to know exactly kind of, you know, where to start.
How much do you think the hardware is part of that? Because, I mean, like, for me personally, I've been sitting here as a core gamer going, these technologies are pretty cool, but, man, they're expensive and there's wires everywhere.
Yep.
So, you know, does the hardware matter? Do we need more, better, cheaper hardware, or do we just need to figure out how to work with what we've got?
No, I mean, look, it's inevitable that these things are going to get less and less intrusive, less intimidating, less expensive, right? I mean, pretty soon we've got the Oculus Quest coming out, and you're not going to be wired to anything, right? and the fidelity will be what people are already used to. So I think as the technology improves, as the headsets get, you know, less imposing in that way, and the cost comes down, I think you're going to see more people adopt it. It's just interesting because it's kind of an isolating experience, right?
True.
And I think people often, especially when they're not automatic early adopters, they're seeking out things that are maybe a little bit more social, you know? I mean, you see something like the Wii going back a few years,
sure.
You know, and obviously
the Rock Band craze.
Right, exactly. All of these things that families felt like, you know, okay, well, we can do this together, right? And suddenly you had grandma and grandpa bowling, you know, and things like that. Like, well, VR is a little different. I mean, yeah, you can all go, well, let's fire that up and then pass the headset around. But, like, it's not like you're really in it together. So I'm not sure what changes there, whether, you know, something like AR is actually going to be more kind of inclusive and social in that way just because it doesn't shut the whole world out.
Right.
I'm not sure. But, like, I think we're all waiting to see what that device is that sort of, again, Trojan horses its way into our homes because suddenly, you know, it's going to be affordable and have some killer apps that people want to.
You mentioned Lone Echo. Have there been any other, for any various reasons, standout VR titles where you like this about, really like this about one game or this about another?
Yeah, I mean, gosh. Astrobot I just played, you know, obviously recently because that just came out on the PSVR and, like, there's something revelatory about that, you know. Somebody else said this too, that it almost feels like the first time you played Mario 64, and your brain kind of goes, "Oh, that's a thing, right?" Like you're experiencing this sort of familiar interaction, but in this new context. You know, it's all the ones people talk about, like Beat Saber, obviously. You know, and when you have something that's that polished, you know, and that experience, Moss is amazing.
Yes.
Gosh, there's so many. I don't want to leave anything out.
Well, how about you mentioned to me actually
Invisible
before
Hours is great.
Yeah, before we got started, you were mentioning we got to talking about the sort of inner the physical VR, the sort of enhanced
based?
VR. Yeah. Mm-hmm. With like the Star Wars thing down at Disneyland.
Yeah,
you worked with them a little bit on that.
I did, yeah. I was consulting with The Void for about 6 months from like sort of May, June until the end of the year. And, you know, again, like I said, the gigs I've been taking are just, you know, it's not because I'm looking for a paycheck exactly. It's more that I want to get my foot in the door somewhere, learn something.
Yeah.
You know, be able to meet certain people that I think are doing interesting stuff. And it's a fascinating problem to solve, you know. I think, you know, more people are going to be exposed to VR through location-based entertainment before they get to it in the home, right? And that may be the thing that converts them because
right.
they might go, that was amazing. Can I do this at home, right? Of course, the experience is different. When you have something like The Void, part of the experience is the fact that it's a sort of one-to-one tactile and sensory
right.
experience.
Physicality of it.
You will never have at home, right? The fact that it's there are four of you going in together, the fact that all the walls are touchable, that you can smell stuff, there's heat, there's fans, you know, like it's pretty immersive because of that. But yes, it was great fun to work with them.
What do you think, you've picked up all the VR hardware and you're checking all those out. Do you hope to see Microsoft jump into the VR space on Xbox? Is it important for moving the VR medium forward to have another major console player
I haven't thought about that before. My gut says no. I mean, it's not like everybody has to be all crowding into the same space. People can focus on the things that they're best at, and you've got companies like Facebook with Oculus, like I think that are probably going to be preeminent until somebody swoops in with some other device we haven't seen coming.
What do you think of? Let's pivot away from VR for a little bit, but. Single-player games get talked about as, for years now, it's like, oh, they're dying, but then, you get to the end of the year and all the Game of the Year nominees, many of them are narrative single-player experiences, and that's been your forte. You're one of the best in the world at those things. What do you see as single-player games' role in the industry moving forward as, games as a service and living games are more and more the chatter?
Right. And then, look, this is the thing. I mean, and I could talk about this for much longer than we have. So we should do that. We'll do a part two. But I think the problem is it's not that single-player games are dead, but some of the single-player storytelling is less front and center, right? So sometimes you're getting the story aspect sidecarred onto a larger experience, right? Or, we say it's a story experience, and it is, but the games are getting so long and sometimes so complex. I mean, look at Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah.
I mean, how many hours does that take to finish?
40 plus minimum.
Right. So how many people are actually going to finish that? Right? And this is not a knock on them.
It's
a beautiful game, right? And so most of us, myself included, will never see the end of that game just because we just don't have time. There's too many other things competing for our time and attention.
Yeah.
Even outside gaming, right? And so that, as a storyteller, sort of fundamentally sits wrong with me. The idea that our medium just makes it peace with the fact that, most people will never actually see the whole arc of the stories we're telling. That's bizarre to me, right? So that the age when we could make games that were, in the non-indie space, right? Make games that are 6 or 8 hours long, don't have any other second modes, don't have a live service, don't have any multiplayer. They're just about this sort of finite, crafted, interactive narrative experience that sticks the landing and is memorable. That's a harder and harder sell, right?
Publisher, if not the gamer themselves, right?
Well, right, and that's the big question I have, is to the publishers, absolutely, because, they're looking, and I don't want to make this sound mercenary on their part, but, they're looking at rising cost of development, takes longer, more people, more money, right? And all of our distribution methods have changed. It's no longer about brick and mortar and, putting a box in a store.
Yeah.
So, and I understand the appeal of saying, we can create a service that people can keep coming back to, as opposed to having a finite experience that, maybe feels like it's aping cinema or TV. But it makes it really hard to tell stories that way, right? Story feels like it becomes, and certainly not for games like God of War and Spider-Man and these things. I mean, story is very important, but it's also sort of counterintuitive that they're still very long, and there's so many subscreens and open world qualities and all this stuff that makes it, that you may never actually see the arc of the story. And so that's why I wonder whether it's for people like me that are kind of interested in telling finite stories, is there a better place for us to shift our attention to, whether that's VR, which is why I explored it, and I'm still exploring it, or whether it's looking towards sort of our streaming future.
Well, I'm running out of time with you because it's dice. You have busy. You got a lot to do.
Sorry, and I'm long-winded too.
I can't help. I have to ask you before you go. And hopefully, we will get to do this again. But The Star Wars project that you were working on at EA, we got to see about 6 seconds of it.
I know, and there's a lot more of it than that. I see occasionally people online go, that's all they had. It's just like, are you kidding me? After, you know, 3 years, we had a lot more than that.
So,
and it's a shame because I feel like I wish the door had gotten cracked open a little bit more. Obviously, Battlefront was front and center because it was coming out first.
Yeah.
And so we were definitely waiting in the wings for our chance, which was imminent, and then... but I wish we had actually shown more of our content, you know, at like a, you know, one of the press events so that people, you know, had got a little bit more of a peek at what we're doing.
So my question is, before you go, is just what were you hoping to achieve with that game? Because, you know, I'm not going to tell you, like, well, what was level four like? And what, this, on a kind of bigger picture, you're, again, you're, gamers were so excited for that game because your resume speaks for itself. And Amy Hennig leading a Star Wars project, a single, like, whoa, that, you know, that's, that would be great. So what was the goal for you? What were you hoping to achieve with that project?
I think this is out there, so I don't think I'm breaking any news here. But, like, obviously, look, I have a certain wheelhouse. I have a certain sort of tone that is my comfort zone. And so Star Wars, obviously, dear to my heart. It falls right into the pocket of the sort of kind of pulpy action adventure. I mean, that was the inspiration. And so I did the same thing that I did for Uncharted, which was, okay, you take, you know, we took these pulp adventure films and deconstructed them, particularly Indiana Jones, of course, and deconstructed them to go, how are they structured? What are the kind of the verbs? What are the requisite parts? And then how do we reconstruct that as a game in an interactive context, but keep that same feeling of pace and propulsion so it feels familiar?
Yeah.
So I did the same thing for Star Wars, right? And the major differences... Because, of course, they share a lot of DNA, right?
Sure.
But the major difference was two things. This one might seem sort of obvious, but, like, the characters have to be a lot more improvisational. Not that Indiana Jones wasn't improvisational, but, like, really leveraging the fact that they were constantly, like, you know, the underdog, which meant they had to be really clever about how they used their environment, how they worked together, all that stuff. So really turning that into a game mechanic that the player could actually be improvisational too. And then the other aspect, of course, is that you look at an Indiana Jones and, you know, he's the protagonist. The other characters are side characters. And they're important, but they're not co-protagonists. In Star Wars, those are ensemble stories, all of them.
Right.
And that means that all those other characters, and you can look at all the films, you can look at Rebels, right? They're all ensemble stories. Every other character is really a co-protagonist. And so that means, and then the only way they achieve their goals, think about Indiana Jones, you almost never cut away from Indy, right?
It's true.
In Star Wars, you cut away a lot because you're actually cutting away. I mean, we would often use the Death Star escape as a perfect example. For them to actually escape and rescue Leia, you know, Obi-Wan had to get the tractor beams down. Han, Luke, and Chewie had to, like, figure out disguises. Again, the improvisational quality,
yes.
Right? Figure out disguises and break into the detention bay. You know, come up with this elaborate ruse, and the droids had to be hacking into the computer system to be helping them. So if you can imagine a game where those qualities were all represented in your cohorts, and that also they would also be playable, because you, if you were playing that, you'd be cutting between playing Han, Luke, or Chewie, you know, Han or Luke probably, and playing Obi-Wan, and maybe playing, you know, R2-D2 or C-3PO, cutting back and forth with that kind of... If you didn't do that in a Star Wars game that was meant to feel like a Star Wars movie, something would feel off and you wouldn't know what it was, but that would be it, that would be it. So fundamentally, that was the DNA, is how do you honor the ensemble nature of Star Wars stories and have this kind of... I mean, the code name was Ragtag, that's out there. It was, you know, this Ragtag sort of, you know... criminal scoundrel crew that you know, has to rise to a greater purpose.
Well, now you're making me miss that
I'm
video
sorry.
Game even more. But
me too.
No, it's we'll talk more. I know I've got to let you go.
No,
Amy Hennig, thank
you
so much. This was a real treat. I hope
all
the
right.
rest of your dice goes fantastically. Yeah. You're presenting an award tonight.
I am, I know, with this voice.
So yeah,
lots
rest
more,
up.
Lots more honey.
And for more with the likes of Amy Hennig and all kinds of the wonderful minds that we have been so blessed with to have making games for us here in the games industry. Stick with IGN. Ryan McCaffrey with IGN. We're here at the DICE Summit in Las Vegas 2019, where the best, brightest, most awesome gaming minds in the industry get together. They share ideas. They catch up. And I've got one of those minds right here next to me, Ted Price, the CEO and co-founder of Insomniac Games. You guys are celebrating your 25th year as a studio this year. Congratulations, number one.
Thank you.
That's awesome. But yeah, so we're here at DICE. Well, you've been to every DICE. You're on the board. What's your favorite part of DICE as somebody who helps put these together and then comes and you know, lives them out?
It is actually catching up with peers here. And because many of us have been to so many DICEs, sometimes it's the only time we get to see each other during the year. And generally, after a great speech, we'll convene outside of the big room the speeches are held in, and we'll talk about them. And I think that's where a lot of great ideas come from. I always walk away from DICE with a lot of cool thoughts about what we should be doing differently, what the industry could be doing better, et cetera.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but do any come to mind as something that you took away and took to a project?
I think generally it's comments on culture. For example...
Studio culture.
So I've been lucky enough to do the Game Maker's Notebook podcasts, and I had an opportunity to talk to one of our Insomniacs, Brian Intihar, on stage, and he was talking about how various things went well and didn't go well in production. And those are always useful. Even though that was a very public event, it was a great conversation for me to understand what we could do better. And I also got the chance to talk to Amy Hennig today, and Kiki Wolfkill, and Shu Yoshida, and every one of them had a different perspective on what makes their gaming culture inside, or their development culture inside their studios, great. And I take ideas back to Insomniac from those talks.
Awesome. What's any favorite things to do in Vegas when you come here every year?
I'm not much of a Vegas person. I don't gamble. I don't really drink that much. So I think going out to the restaurants is exciting, because they're some of the best restaurants in the world here. And it is always surprising what you can find. It's expensive, really expensive, but it generally the restaurants work really hard to make it an experience for
you. So I got the chance to sit down with you a little, 4 or 5 months ago, right before Spider-Man shipped. And that, as a lot of us had suspected, turned into a very, very big deal for you guys, for the industry, for Marvel. How has life been since Spider-Man shipped?
Calm. It probably would have been a lot less calm had it not been very well received by the fans. So we were really humbled and honored to get the response that we did. And I think most of us now have had experiences where we've talked to a fan about Spider-Man and their experiences playing either by themselves or with friends or with family. And it sort of validates what we were going for, which was to deliver a positive message and to tell a story that people would really identify.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I
wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
By any metric you choose, I mean, is it Insomniac's most successful game ever, or a studio with a decorated history?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've been very proud of all the games we've made, and I mean, from the beginning, even Disruptor, like our very first game, just getting that game out the door was a major accomplishment for us, and then moving to Spyro, where we completely shifted gears, and then Ratchet, which had a lot of firsts for us. And the list goes on. There was Resistance, Sunset Overdrive, all of our VR games. We learned something on every single game. And so for us, while this game has been tremendously successful, and we owe a ton of gratitude to Sony and Marvel, our partners on it, for us, we learned a ton. And I think it's helped us evolve even further as a studio in terms of our ability to take on bigger, more complex games, because we had to grow, not just in terms of our size, but in terms of our systems and production processes during Spider-Man.
Give me an example. Like what you know, because I'm sure you guys by now have done a thorough postmortem on Spider-Man internally. What, you know, and obviously it was a huge success critically and commercially. What are maybe one or two of the big kind of big picture takeaways that you'll apply to the next project for the team?
Well, to be fair, we are still doing postmortems. And so there's a lot to talk about in terms of how we what we liked and what we didn't like about the game's production. So I think one key takeaway was we need to have more efficient pre-productions. And that means knowing what the pillars are very early, knowing which game systems we really need to build, knowing what matters and what doesn't matter, and what questions we can leave until later. Those are things that we've now identified much more clearly in terms of how what's key when we attack the next big game.
Has the studio huge success here of Spider-Man, has it changed life at Insomniac in any way, either for I'd assume for the better?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all happy that it's been a success. And whenever you have a successful game, whether it's sales-wise or ratings-wise or fan response-wise, it gives you confidence, right? And so I think we as a studio have even more confidence to take on the same kinds of challenges we face as the industry evolves. And as we look ahead, no question that what players want continues to evolve as well. They want bigger games, more complex stories, better meshing between narrative and game design. So we have more confidence to take creative risks and try different things.
It's funny, I had Amy Hennig in that same chair earlier today, and she was talking about how, you know, we got onto the topic of single player games, of which Spider-Man obviously is, and she actually had mentioned Spider-Man as an excellent recent example. But she made an interesting point, I thought, about how you know, something like a Red Dead Redemption 2, as brilliant as it is, being a 40-ish hour game just on the single player side, let alone all the side stuff, is a little, as a storyteller for her, that's a challenge, because it's like, how many of your players are going to see through that story to the end? So gamers seem to want or say they want bigger and better and more, but, you know, do you have to kind of be careful at Insomniac to not bloat your next game too much and to try to maintain that focus on telling a story that everybody will really enjoy all of?
I think it's more about making sure that the game design serves the story and vice versa. So as no matter what you're doing in the game, if it feels like it's somehow connected to who the characters are, what their emotional challenges are going through the game, and not something that's tacked on, that's for us the goal. And did we succeed in Spider-Man in doing that consistently? No, we didn't. I mean, I think some of our side content feels a little bit detached, and I think that that's an area we can improve. And the fans call that out. And that's the kind of feedback that we like to get, because we want to know what players liked and what players didn't. And it gives us something to work on as well. So in terms of overall time in the game and how big games need to be, I think every game is different. And it really depends on what the kind of the expectations you're creating for fans, right? There are some franchises out there that already have expectations that have been set,
right?
And so if you deliver if your franchise has been typically 40 plus hours and you deliver one that's 15 hours long, then yeah, you got a problem.
That's a good point. I want to go back on it to ask you almost the same question I asked you a couple minutes ago, but for frame to set a different way. I'm kind of curious, has the success of Spider-Man and those lessons that you've learned and are kind of picking apart through your postmortems, has the philosophy of Insomniac or even the roadmap, has Spider-Man's success sort of changed the course of the studio in any way, or more just kind of reaffirmed that the course you're already on is the right one?
I think it's helped us figure out where we need to put more effort. And one area is in leadership training. So we have a lot of leaders at Insomniac, from called executives to department heads to leads, creative directors, project managers, and we all help work with the entire team to make sure we're moving in the same direction.
Yeah.
And so during Spider-Man, a game like Spider-Man puts immense pressure on leadership and shared resources. And when that happens, and when we start focusing inward on, say, the daily challenges, it's easy to forget all the things that we should be doing as leaders more consistently. Mentoring, spending time with each team member, asking, is everything going okay? Are there things that we should be changing as a studio? So we really spent a lot of time over the last year and a half doing leadership seminars, actually getting together as a leadership team and talking about what is it that we could do better as leaders so that our creative team can move forward efficiently and smoothly without a lot of roadblocks.
So, I mean, we talked about this last time you and I sat down. You know, Insomniac's been frequently cited as one of the best places to work. You guys have clearly cultivated a culture in which you care about and care for your employees. How do you do that across two bi-coastal teams?
A lot of communication. So Chad DeZern, who's our chief creative officer, and Sean McCabe, our chief technical officer, are based in North Carolina. So they'll fly out to Burbank to make sure that they're connecting with everybody. John Fiorita, who's our chief operating officer, and I will fly out to North Carolina to check in. And then we have leads and seniors from each team who also will fly back and forth. But then there are the obvious ways to connect. There's Skype, there's Slack. We try to stay as connected as possible. And when we have, say, a department that spans both coasts, we will have meetings with, you know, like most companies do, with half the team on a big television and half the team in the room. And we do our best to make sure that we're all keeping each other informed.
Do the realities, I mean, Amy was talking about this when I had her here, and it's plain to see to really anyone in the industry, making AAA games continues to get more expensive, more manpower. Will we be looking at the two Insomniac teams working on one project?
We have more than two Insomniac teams. So we look at ourselves as
the two studios, I guess, the two offices. Maybe.
Yeah, and we look at ourselves as one company.
Yeah.
Right? We share everything. We share culture. We share technology. We share processes. We try not to think of ourselves as two separate Insomniacs at all. In fact, that's been the goal from the very beginning. So what we have done in the past successfully is we have had a lot of cross-country collaboration on projects. The last Ratchet game that we released, for example, was a bi-coastal effort where we were shifting responsibilities. And that was awesome because we have a lot of fans of Ratchet in both locations.
Sure. What has Marvel's reaction been to Spider-Man's success?
Very positive.
I'm sort of curious. You know, do you get? Do they? Are they taken? aback at all by how well it's done?
I think you'd have to ask Marvel that.
But that they communicate to you, I guess.
Marvel's incredibly gracious, and they have been fantastic partners with us. And from the very beginning, they trusted us with their most beloved franchise, and they asked us to create an original take on one of their best franchises. And they worked with us hand in hand along the way to help answer the hard questions. I mean, there were definitely times where we asked Bill Roseman, for example, the creative director at Marvel, hey, would Peter do this? Does this make sense for the IP? We're planning to take some creative risks. Does this fit? And Marvel was always honest and open with us about what worked and what didn't. And they and Sony, our Sony producers, were part of this creative team that helped just build something that we thought was, you know, a very interesting and different take.
What did you think of Into the Spider-Verse?
I loved it.
Right? How good was that movie?
That's fantastic. And I think that was a good example of Marvel and Sony taking some really interesting creative risks.
Yeah.
And did it strike a chord.
Last time we talked, you told me the story about how you were basically offered carte blanche, which pick a superhero and go. And you're saying that Spider-Man was actually like the last one you thought of because, you know, he's been done a lot.
Yeah, that's what I assumed, and that kind of shows my ignorance of Spider-Man's history in video games, because I didn't realize that it had been a long time since there had been a Spider-Man. Well, not a long time, but there had been a good period of time since the last Spider-Man game came out. And so in talking to the team, and especially Brian Intihar, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of Spider-Man, then it became clear that, this actually would be a good time to put out a Spider-Man game. Plus, as a studio, we had an affinity for who Spider-Man is and who Peter Parker is.
So the follow-up there is now in the wake of Spider-Man's success, are you guys kind of going back into the roster, into the cabinet of superheroes and going, oh, who else might we want to go play with here?
We had a lot of fun doing that initially, looking down the big list of Marvel heroes. I mean, I actually wasn't aware of how many incredible Marvel heroes there are and how many have just been built over the years by the Marvel team. I mean, it goes way, way back.
Yeah.
And there are some incredible stories. So we kind of went through that process at the very beginning when we were looking at, okay, who do we think we could tell the best story about?
Is there like a surprise, neat thing that's happened since it came out? Either like a super cool fan letter or some like celebrity mentioning it, or is there any sort of just extracurricular thing that's found your attention about Spider-Man?
The best thing that has happened so far, in my opinion, happened today. Josh Straub, who runs an accessibility group, gave us an award for accessibility, for actually building in controls that would help disabled people play the game.
Yeah.
That, I think, will mean more to Insomniacs than any award we could have gotten.
Absolutely, yeah. Microsoft, that adaptive controller they made is fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think the fact that they put that up during the Super Bowl was really cool. The whole accessibility is important.
Yeah.
We need to help people who want to play games but may not have the same abilities that, you know, most players have. So that's important.
You guys had a killer voice cast too. Was that a pretty easy process? When the good ones come in, you got to know, right?
I laugh because it's never easy. And I think if you talk to Brian Intihar, our creative director, and Paul Mudra, who is our audio director, finding the right voice, finding a group of actors who can channel the character and also be part of the creative process is tough.
Yeah.
We were very fortunate, for example, for Spider-Man to be able to draw on one of our longtime Insomniac friends, Yuri Lowenthal. And he did an incredible job as Peter.
Yeah, it was just fantastic. I have to ask, too, like on the sort of the business side of things, you know, you've worked a lot with Sony, we talked about that, but, you know, you are an independent studio. So since Spider-Man shipped, has the volume of calls from other publishers wanting to work with you gone up?
Well, we've been very fortunate in that we have good relationships with a lot of publishers in the business, and I don't think that things have changed in terms of their interest in working with us and the opportunities that exist in the industry. I think what's particularly interesting, though, is as we get to the call it, quote-unquote end of this console life cycle, we're looking ahead to big changes in the industry. And it could be anything. I mean, I think this year we'll probably see a lot of announcements about where tech is going in the games industry. And nobody, I think, can accurately predict where it's going to go. What's important for us as a company is that we are flexible. We have weathered the various storms and roller coaster rides that have occurred over the last 25 years, and I anticipate we'll be able to continue doing that.
What excites you about a console shift? As a just veteran decorated studio, what do you hope to see that these new machines deliver?
That's a good question. So there are a lot of things they could, and I could opine about that, but people are already doing that online. So that's me sort of deferring the question. What I do look forward to, though, is just the continued growth of the audience. And I think that, I mean, games like Fortnite, phenomenon in this industry, have brought in more and more players to our industry. And I don't think anybody could have predicted that. And I look at my daughters playing Fortnite and being passionate about the game, and their friends coming in. And now my third daughter is not really a gamer, and she's not a self-professed gamer, but she started playing Spider-Man because she played Fortnite. Fortnite actually got her into playing with the PlayStation 4, right? And she said, "Oh, wait, Dad, but you made this other game. Maybe I should try this other game." And so she did, and she loved it. So super, super microcosm example of what I believe could be happening across the world.
And then you broke down and wept tears of fatherhood. Like that had to be a great moment.
It was a bonding awesome. Moment with my daughter and me, yes.
All right, so Sunset Overdrive is a game that's very near and dear to my heart. We talked a little bit about it last time, but so since we spoke, it finally came to PC.
Yes.
Which was great. A lot of people loved seeing that. So does this mean that you guys control its future now? And is Sunset Overdrive 2 on the radar? Is it you want to just extinguish any hope that I'm never going to play that game right now? Do you want to fuel it a little bit? Just talk to me about that, because that is a new development since you and I last sat down.
You know, it's funny that I've been asked similar questions about Resistance. Right, and I remember at one point saying, "Now we're not going to do another Resistance." And then I said, "That's stupid. I shouldn't say something like that," because it wasn't, you know, at that point I figured, yeah, there's always a chance that we might do another Resistance, so never say never. With Sunset, I got to hand it to Blind Squirrel. Blind Squirrel took our engine and our tools and created a beautiful version of Sunset Overdrive for the PC, and in collaboration with Microsoft. So.
Yeah.
Kudos to them, and it's really great for us to see fans who didn't get a chance to play Sunset, or people who had heard of Sunset, get a chance to play it on PC. So I'm going to say never. How's that? That is a long-winded way to say it.
I'll give you one follow-up, though, because it's, you know, I have a lot of Xbox fans in my timeline. I've covered Xbox for a long time. And, you know, when the PC version came out, a lot of Xbox fans were like, "Hey, well, how about if there's a PC version now, can we get an Xbox One X enhanced version?" So you're sitting here, I'm contractually obliged to ask you about that.
I think that's unlikely.
Unlikely. Yeah. All right. Well, you know what? I appreciate the straight answer. Because things cost money, right? And there's opportunity costs for everything, I
exactly.
imagine.
Exactly. I mean, we are 200, almost 300 strong right now at Insomniac, but it's something that, you're right, it's an opportunity cost. What should we do? Where should we put our energy when it comes to new projects, IP that we control? And those are hard decisions to make.
All right, so the odds are good that your Insomniac's next game will probably be on the next generation of consoles. I mean, if the timelines are what a lot of people think they are. You know, you sort of touched on this a minute ago, but, you know, What is the new tech that's going to fuel everything? I mean, you know, I've heard a lot of developers here at DICE talk about cloud computing and who's going to crack that, and or, you know, do we just need more RAM, more CPU power? Is there something that you see that's sort of key to growing gaming in the future from a technology perspective?
From a technology perspective, I can't really talk about that because I I think there's, again, a lot of speculation out there about what could be coming down the road. And there have been some announcements from big players who are outside of this industry in terms of where they want to take things. So it's better for me, I think, to talk about the kinds of features that we've wanted in games and hopefully can get more adept at least at Insomniac. I think that we love telling story-driven games, big open-world story-driven games, and I think a challenge that we have is answering the question, how can we keep players engaged? Players love these worlds, and what do we do to figure out how to create content that lives well beyond, you know, the game's typical life cycle? And people call that games as a service. You can call it whatever you want to.
Right.
But that's a production challenge, given that when we build these really big games, you don't know how they're going to be received, right? And so you take a big risk in committing to continuing to put out content afterwards. And we put out 3 episodes of City That Never Sleeps after Spider-Man. That was a massive effort for us because they're all story-driven. We put a lot of effort into figuring out what those storylines would be. The whole team was on it. And so you can keep doing that, but will the appetite continue for a while? Does it tail off? So we don't have answers to those questions at all. But I think what I think I'm looking forward to over the next couple years is seeing what other companies do, right? There are other companies that are in the middle of their production cycles right now that will be releasing in 2019, 2020 on whatever platforms are available.
Right.
And I think we're going to see how the audience reacts to those and what features other developers are taking risks on. We learn from that. We look around at our peers, we look at the industry, and we pay attention to what works and what doesn't. And then we take our own risks further down the road, but we take informed risks.
Yeah. And how has it worked for how has the appetite been for those DLCs on Spider-Man?
It's been great. I mean, we've had a lot of positive feedback from people saying, "Thank you for continuing the story. I loved seeing more Silver Sable. I loved the Hammerhead, you know, appearance and who learning more about who he is." So those are the kinds of things that help us feel good about what we're doing. It helps us inform us for the future. You know, what kinds of stories should we be telling? How should we elevate these potentially minor characters in the game?
All good.
It's all good.
All good for you guys.
Yeah. Again, fans are not shy about giving us comments, good and bad, about what they liked and didn't like. And that just goes into the Insomniac brainstorming sessions about what we want to do in the future, regardless of IP, right? It all is informative, regardless of what type of game we're working on.
Last question before I let you get out of here. Are we still going to keep doing the console generation thing, do you think, for a while? Or are we heading for more of a smartphone-like, iterative kind of technology future with gaming?
You talk to console manufacturers and they give you different answers, right? So I don't know. I mean, if I think back to the right before the PlayStation 4, a lot of journalists were saying this is the end of consoles. This generation is going to fail and there will be no more consoles after that. But the converse happened, right? Sony has killed it this generation and has, I think, broken records in terms of the number of consoles
they've
been able to ship. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's driven by content, right? Do you have content that justifies a different approach to consoles and console upgrades? That's my opinion as a content creator.
Well, Ted, thank you so much for taking more of your life to sit down with me. And now I'm fully caught up on all things Ted Price. From the beginning of your career, now all the way through past Spider-Man. It's just wonderful to speak with you. I wish you nothing, but your success is just so deserved with both Spider-Man and 25 years of Insomniac as a studio. So thank you so much for your time once again.
Thanks, Ryan. It's been fun to be here.
Yeah, and for more from DICE, with a lot of great developers like Ted Price, keep it locked right here on IGN.
Hey folks, I'm Yen.
And I'm Nat.
And we're the hosts of Comic Sans, the podcast about comics for those who are sans knowledge.
Comic Sans is a show for people who know nothing about comics, like me.
And people who love them, like me, and want to learn more about them.
What makes you an authority on comic books?
I read them, write them, live them, breathe them. What makes you the authority on knowing nothing?
Honestly, Yen, 2 seasons in, I actually know a little more than I used to.
You're welcome. know, the reason for that is that every episode I make Nat read one of my favorite comics, like Daredevil Saga or this one Summer.
And then he tells me what makes that comic so special.
And then I hear what Nat thinks and I try to avoid a pulmonary embolism.
While I actively try to give him one.
You can listen to the second season of Comic Sans now.
With new episodes every 2 weeks.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Yen, I think I know so much about comics now that this might have to be our last season.
Nat, there will forever be more comic than you will ever know.
What does that even mean?
I don't know. It sounds profound, though. Right?